Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
For families, we know the demand is there, the demand is actually increasing, but the supply is not at the pace that we need to support families who need it.
New school start times have Anchorage families wondering where they'll find care for young kids. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, cases of whooping cough are on the rise in Alaska.
We have so far had over 100 cases of pertussis this year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed 5 bills today that lawmakers passed after midnight on the last day of the legislative session. Dunleavy says the bills, which passed on what was technically the 122nd day of the session, violated the Alaska Constitution's limit on the length of the legislative session. Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone explains.
Article 2, Section 8 of the Alaska Constitution says the legislature must adjourn, quote, no later than 120 consecutive calendar days after it convenes. In 1989, the Alaska Supreme Court found that the constitutional length of the session was actually 121 days. The justices found that the first day didn't count under the constitutional wording. And all of the bills that Dunleavy vetoed were passed after midnight, making it day 122. That is one day later than the deadline. And an Alaska political blog had promised to challenge the bills in court if they were signed into law. So what are the bills? Well, they cover a wide variety of topics. Most would make simple but consequential changes to state law. One, sponsored by Big Lake Republican Kevin McCabe, would prevent insurance companies from discriminating against elected officials. Another would eliminate what the sponsor, Kodiak Republican Louise Stutz, says are redundant registration requirements for large vessels documented by the Coast Guard. A third, from Fairbanks Republican Frank Tomaszewski, would allow the Alaska Railroad to issue bonds to replace a passenger dock and terminal in Seward. The fourth, from House Labor and Commerce Committee Chair and Wasilla Republican Jesse Sumner, would allow people under 21 to serve alcohol and require bars to post signs saying that alcohol can cause cancer. And the last, also from Sumner, would expand employers' ability to pay salaries and wages electronically, including with something like a prepaid debit card. Now, lawmakers can call themselves into special session to attempt to override the vetoes or simply repass the bills. The editorial board of the state's largest newspaper, the Anchorage Daily News, recently urged Dunleavy to call a special session to repass the bills to avoid the very constitutional issues that Dunleavy cited in his veto message. But instead, Dunleavy is telling lawmakers to try again next year and reintroduce the bills at the start of the next legislative session early next year. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Financial documents published Wednesday by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation show the fund lacks enough spendable money to immediately pay for items in the state's annual budget. It's a sign that the state's top source of general purpose revenue is on course for a future crisis. The Alaska Beacon reports this year lawmakers and Governor Mike Dunleavy approved a $1 billion transfer from the spendable portion of the permanent fund to the constitutionally protected principal. As of July 1st, there was only $571.7 million available to transfer. Because the fund is expected to earn additional money in the coming months, the shortfall is not an immediate problem. But it is the latest signal that the fund's ability to pay for state services and the permanent fund dividend may soon be in jeopardy. The permanent fund is the number one source of general purpose revenue for the state. Oil revenue plus all other taxes is expected to generate $2.8 billion for the state during the fiscal year that began July 1st. The permanent fund, meanwhile, will transfer $3.7 billion to the state treasury, paying for state services and this year's permanent fund dividend. This year's transfer is not in danger, nor is next year's, but transfers beyond 2026 may be. When school begins this month in Anchorage, families will be adjusting to very different start times for elementary, middle, and high school. The new times are designed to increase graduation rates by improving performance for older students, but childcare experts say the sector is already facing a crisis and worry the new schedules will make it even more difficult for families to find care for young kids. Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky reports.
Philip Walters is preparing to go back to the classroom as a middle school band teacher. He's been teaching for nearly 20 years, but this year is different. He has no idea who's going to watch his two young boys after school. They'll be out at 2:30, but he won't get home until 4:30.
We're going to kind of fly by the seat of our pants. And I kind of feel like that's a lot of people are going to be in that situation where they don't really know what this is going to look like until it starts happening, and then they're just going to have to figure something out.
The Walters' oldest son has been on a wait list for nearby childcare for 5 years. Walters says he and his wife will likely ask friends and neighbors for help watching their children. And if that doesn't work, he says they may have to consider something more drastic.
When this came up, Jamie and I talked about it, and the possibility of her having to quit her job or reduce her hours is very real. If we can't find a consistent friend or relative that can watch the boys.
The Walters family is not alone. In a survey of nearly 1,000 Alaska parents last year, 1 in 4 people said they had reduced work hours, quit, or changed their job to care for their children in recent years. When the Anchorage School Board voted to change start times, they based their decision on research that shows when older students start later, they get more sleep and better grades. Most members voted in favor of the change, but the vote to postpone it until the start of this school year was split. Several board members acknowledged the childcare shortage and wanted to give providers and parents time to adjust. Here's Dora Wilson, who voted to postpone the start times change last May.
I think our staff, our community, our programs, our families, our community partners deserve the time to prepare for this change.
But a year later, there's no sign childcare is any easier to secure in Anchorage. Stephanie Berglund is the CEO of Thread, a nonprofit that works to improve access to childcare. She says overall, there are about 10,000 more children in Anchorage that need supervision than there are slots in childcare facilities.
For families, we know the demand is there. The demand is actually increasing, but the supply is not at the pace that we need to support families who need it.
Two government working groups are currently studying solutions to the childcare shortage. Local childcare providers in Anchorage have been meeting with school district staff to discuss transportation, nutrition, and the potential for new childcare programs around the district. Mel Hooper is the CEO of Campfire Alaska, the state's largest school-age childcare provider. She says they've had to close more than a dozen facilities since the pandemic began because of the difficulty finding employees and covering operating costs.
The childcare sector is not stable. I think a lot of people think we're 4 years past the pandemic, right? There's been a lot of investment into it, but we continue to need to stabilize. And so I think the important thing here is there's not one solution that's gonna stabilize the industry. It's continuous invested time and resources that will stabilize our industry.
Some help is on the way in the form of a $7.5 million subsidy included in the state's budget this year to boost pay for childcare employees. But high school students, who had accounted for over a third of the workforce at Campfire, will be in class during the organization's aftercare programs. Emily Joyce says she previously relied on high schoolers to babysit, but that's no longer an option. She's also a teacher and has 5- and 7-year-old daughters who need afternoon care. Joyce is thankful her mother can help, but says there is no backup plan.
If grandma is unavailable in an emergency situation, she's sick, whatever the case may be, that's where my panic starts to set in.
Joyce says she typically gets excited for the start of school, but this year she feels anxious. Providers and district staff are asking parents to explore available options now and not wait until school starts to try to find a solution. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Seldovia hosts a summer concert series on the water.
People are on paddle boards, on boats, on the deck, just everywhere, just hanging out, and it's just like a big community party.
That's ahead. Stay with us. The former law clerk of a resigned federal judge says the Alaska U.S. Attorney's Office retaliated against her for complaining about the judge's sexual misconduct. That's according to a report by Bloomberg Law. The woman went to work in the U.S. Attorney's Office after her clerkship with then-Judge Joshua Kindred ended. Bloomberg reports that the woman found out that she no longer had a job through an office-wide email in September of last year. Kindred resigned last month amid allegations of, quote, unwanted, offensive, and abusive sexual conduct in the office and with clerks. The U.S. Attorney's Office did not answer detailed questions from the Bloomberg reporters, but a spokesperson said the office was mindful of its employees' rights and the importance of the integrity of the judicial system. The former clerk was working at the U.S. Attorney's Office on a one-year employment term that was not renewed. Alaska has a high rate of whooping cough this year. There have been 105 cases so far this year compared to only 26 for all of 2023. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra reports.
Alaska's rates of whooping cough have risen dramatically this year. Joe McLaughlin is an epidemiologist with the state's Division of Public Health. He says Alaska's case numbers mirror a national trend.
We have so far had over 100 cases of pertussis this year, which is more cases of pertussis than we've seen in a long time. And the hospitalization rate among young infants who get pertussis is quite high. So that's concerning.
Whooping cough, or pertussis, is a bacterial infection that's most risky for babies under 1 year old. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, a third of babies under 1 year old who get whooping cough will be hospitalized for it. And 1 in 100 of those babies will die from it. McLaughlin says the best way to protect infants is to vaccinate them and the adults around them. The cough spreads easily through the air. McLaughlin says most whooping cough cases in Alaska are among children who aren't up to date with their vaccinations. Whooping cough starts with mild, cold-like symptoms like low fever, cough, and stuffy nose. The cough may linger for months. And especially in babies, children, and the elderly, it can become more severe.
They'll cough and cough and cough and cough, and then they'll go through oftentimes an apneic period where they actually stop breathing, sometimes for 20 seconds or longer. And then they'll take this big respiratory, like, inhale.
McLaughlin says if you're sick with cold-like symptoms this summer, it's most likely COVID, but it also could be whooping cough. He says healthcare practitioners can test for both, and people who have whooping cough can get treated with antibiotics. He says the earlier the people get tested and treated, the better. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
The Karluk River Chinook Salmon Run on the southwest corner of Kodiak Island is coming in at its lowest level ever recorded by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. It's the latest area in the state seeing declines in Chinook or King Salmon. KMXT's Davis Hovey reports.
By the end of last week, less than 70 King Salmon passed through the Karluk River Weir. That's roughly 300 less fish than this time last year. But it's the latest dismal year in the Kodiak management area where Karluk Kings haven't hit their escapement goal for the last two seasons.
I think it's pretty inexplainable. Obviously, something is happening in the marine environment that's affecting these things.
Doug Vincent Lang is the commissioner of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. A KMXT interview request with a local Fish and Game office was sent directly to him due to statewide concerns over Chinook numbers. A major part of the concern is a petition to list certain Gulf of Alaska Chinook stocks under Endangered Species Act protections. That's currently being considered by the federal government. That petition wouldn't just affect Kodiak. It could also have implications for other areas of the state, too, which are facing declining king salmon numbers and even reductions in the size of the fish. That includes heavily fished locations like the Copper and Yukon Rivers. Vincent Lang says the department is concerned about the declining Chinook numbers in the Kodiak area and is doing everything it can to manage the harvest of king salmon. Something else he says that could be done outside of restricting fishing is to look to local hatcheries for help.
We actually got some money through Congress to look at how we're going to rehabilitate these stocks, and maybe it's time to look at rehabilitation of that stock by taking eggs and raising some of the eggs in a hatchery, then basically boosting the numbers just to make sure that we have a maintaining genetic diversity of that stock.
But without knowing what exactly is causing declining Chinook numbers, it's difficult to find the right solution. The commissioner believes something is happening to juvenile salmon out in the ocean, and that's the big unanswered question the department needs to answer.
We know kind of what we're putting in terms of eggs into the gravel. but we really don't have a very good snapshot of what's happening to those juveniles when they're born out of the gravel and what may be impacting their survival until they get out to the ocean. We're starting to piece together that first month and a half out at the ocean, but that juvenile piece we're still missing.
Vincent Lang adds that changing ocean conditions from climate change have impacted Chinook salmon within the last 10 to 15 years. That includes warming waters, changes in food source availability, and more predators like marine mammals eating young kings. The commissioner says in the face of all these challenges for Chinook, Fish and Game is looking to conduct more research and wants to find out what is happening to king salmon across Alaska's waters.
So I think there's going to be a push for federal and state money to better address what's happening to Chinook salmon in the next year's budget. I just don't know what that is yet because we're still putting it together.
Meanwhile, in the commercial fishery for the entire Kodiak area, currently all Chinook salmon 28 inches or greater in length cannot be retained by purse seine gear and must be returned to the water unharmed. The most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the local Alaska Department of Fish and Game office's 24-hour phone recording. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Davis Hovey.
Alaska tends to be home to more Winter Olympians than summer, but there are two Alaskans competing for Team USA at the Summer Games in Paris and another on the South Sudanese team. One is Eagle River's Alev Kelter, a center on the U.S. Rugby Sevens team, who on Tuesday won a bronze medal, defeating an Australian team as time ran out in the match. Also competing in Paris is Kristen Faulkner, a Homer cyclist, whose road race and team pursuit events are this weekend and early next week. Then there's JT Thor, who grew up in Anchorage and plays basketball for South Sudan, the youngest country on Earth, making a mark in its first Olympics. Back here in Alaska, Anchorage Daily News sports reporter Josh Reed has been following the Alaska Olympians and writing profiles on them, starting with rugby star Alev Kelter.
She grew up in Eagle River, went to high school at Chugiak, didn't play rugby growing up at all. So, like, you know, she was a soccer player and a hockey player growing up, and that's what she did in college, too, at Wisconsin, her and her twin sister. She didn't discover rugby until after college when she was trying to make the Olympic team for hockey. And then once she did make the cut there, she kind of just, like, wondered, well, where do I go from here? And then one of her coaches, somebody suggested to her that she, you know, give rugby a try. And then 2 years later, she's in the Rio Olympics for rugby. So that was her first time around in 2016. And, you know, now she's, you know, this is like her third time going to the Olympics.
You talked to her about what it meant to her to come from Alaska and to be, you know, on this international stage. What did she tell you about that? I mean, like, what, you know, from Alaska kind of helped her on that journey?
So being from Alaska, so she said, she, like, you know, being Alaskan taught me what it was to be, like, you know, like a team player, and everything she knows about what you became as a rugby player, she learned from being Alaskan. You know, I was born and raised here myself, to where you, especially if you live in, like, more rural communities, like, people have to come together to support each other, right? Because you're not gonna make it through these cold winters by yourself. So everything she learned about being a team player, about being a leader, about, you know, being who she was, she learned from being Alaskan, and that's what she took a lot of pride in, not just representing her country, but her home state as well.
Yeah, and I think in your story too, she said it's like that's her identity, right? Like, people call her the Alaskan, and, you know, now she's able to hang this bronze medal around her neck, and that was an exciting match. They went into this bronze medal match with Australia, right? And can you kind of describe how they pulled that out at the end to win the bronze medal?
This is basically equivalent to a Hail Mary in football, or maybe not even a Hail Mary, but like one of those pitchy woo woo kind of things, last ditch effort. It was a scrum, and the person who was carrying the ball refused to go down, and I guess they thought it was over, and she busted through and just took off, and that technically tied the game. That tied the match, so it didn't necessarily win it for them. That's why, like, they were celebrating, but their coach was like, hey, calm down, you still got to get the extra kick, the kick for the 2 points to win it. And prior to that point, 11 had the only points for them of the game. They weren't necessarily expected to win after being down, but to have that happen is play like the equivalent to like a Hail Mary or something in football. So that was a pretty exciting way to end the match. I'm pretty sure Australia was stunned and devastated at the same time, but it was a great way for the American team to win their first Olympic medal ever. So that was great.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You said Alev had the only points up to that point in the game. So it's one of those things where, like, there's the game winner, but if you didn't score the try before that, you're not in contention at all, right?
Exactly.
So I wanted to talk to you about another athlete with really strong ties to Alaska and to Anchorage, but is not on Team USA. And that's JT Thor. He's a player on the South Sudanese basketball team. And even before the Olympics, there were exhibition games, right, that team was playing, other Olympic basketball teams were playing, kind of getting ready for the Olympics. And they made some big news in that exhibition game against Team USA, right?
Yeah, he's a kid that, you know, grew up in Alaska for most of his adolescence, from like age 5 till about, he was like 14 or 15 when he moved away to continue his prep career elsewhere in Lower 48 so he could, you know, get a college scholarship. But yeah, so he was born in Omaha, Nebraska. That's where his parents immigrated from when they left what was formerly Sudan, now South Sudan. And so like a lot of people from Sudan migrated to the United States. You know, there's a huge contingent of them that migrated to Alaska. JT's parents weren't part of that, but he eventually came up here. He had some other family that was already up here. His cousin Goy, who's over there with him right now in Paris. But yeah, the South Sudanese team, man, like they gave Team USA all they can handle and then some in that exhibition match. And JT actually hit what was almost a game winner. So he had like a, I think it was a 3-pointer with like 20 seconds left in the game to give them like a 1-point lead. Unfortunately, you know, LeBron James did LeBron James things and went coast to coast and gave Team USA the winning bucket in the end. But it's the fact that they were able to push that star-studded group of Steph Curry, LeBron James, you know, Kevin Durant, Anthony Davis, all these well-known, the best players in the world. You know, Team USA is projected to win it all. And the fact that that South Sudanese team, even though it was an exhibition, they were able to push that team and only lose by a handful of points was very impressive and kind of gave them confidence heading into the pool play. And then they got their first Olympic victory against Puerto Rico earlier this week.
Well, so then I wanted to ask you too. There's a cyclist on Team USA from Homer, and her name's Kristen Faulkner. And she's a road cyclist. And I guess I wonder, you know, what event or events is she competing in, and are those coming up still?
Yeah, so she might be competing in 3 events, but as of right now, she's committed to 2, which are happening on the 6th and the 7th next week. She may be competing in her first event on Sunday, which is the 4th, but she hasn't committed to that one yet. But I mean, she will definitely be competing in 2 events next week.
That was Josh Reed, a sports reporter at the Anchorage Daily News. You can find his stories about Alev Kelter and JT Thor at ADN.com. You can also find an interview with Homer cyclist and fellow Alaska Olympian Kristen Faulkner on Outdoor Explorer. That's at alaskapublic.org. Just look for Outdoor Explorer under the Listen tab. Dozens of boats, kayaks, and paddleboards filled the Seldovia Slough last Saturday. It's not just for any regular aquatic activity, though. They lined up for the 4th annual Songs on the Slough, a summer concert on the water. KBBI's Jamie Deep was at the show and has this story.
Live music rang across the water from the band Agents of Karma as bubbles filled the air around concertgoers. Some people had grills under boats while others tossed drinks to nearby folks on kayaks. Landbound people filled houses and a bridge overlooking the slough while kids ran and danced around. Will Hole came across the concert after a day of fishing in the area.
Well, this one's particularly awesome because you got all these crafts on the water. Hanging out, and we're all standing here on a bridge watching the concert from here.
It's a unique kind of event for the remote town. Seldovia is on the south side of Kachemak Bay and is only accessible by boat or plane. Songs on the Slough was started by a local couple, John and Jane Cedor, who wanted to host an event for the small, tight-knit community. Ashley Keithley is a Seldovia Arts Council board member. She says the council organized this year's event with guidance from the Cedors.
They have just made it happen year after year and had the idea of passing it on, the baton on, and not having to organize all of it once they showed it could work.
Keithley says word has spread about the concert to the point where people mentioned it during a trade show in Anchorage.
There was people talking about it up there like, oh my God, it was the coolest thing we ever went to. People on paddle boards, on boats, on the deck, just everywhere, just hanging out. And it's just like a big community party.
But there were some changes this year. The council expanded the concert to a 2-day event with Friday nights festivities taking place on a floating dock in the city's harbor.
We've been calling it Songs on the Slough times two. We decided we wanted to make it a little bigger, give the opportunity and encourage people to stay the night, or if people couldn't be here Saturday, they can come Friday.
This year's concert also coincided with the Jackaloff Bay 10-miler, a running and biking race from Jackaloff Bay into Seldovia. Marilyn Whitaker lives in Anchorage and came to the rural town to compete in the race. While she didn't go out onto the water, Whitaker says she enjoyed the music with other listeners on the bridge.
The friend I ran the race with told us that there would be music tonight, and so we were really looking forward to it, and one of the main reasons we decided to stay the night.
Songs on the Slough should return next year. Paddling a kayak in Seldovia, I'm Jamie Deep.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Liz Ruskin and Rachel Cassandra in Anchorage, Ben Townsend in Nome, Davis Hovey in Kodiak, and Jamie Deep out there on the water in Seldovia. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.